Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 4:17 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time, and today is February 17th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term video audio for the various different asset classes. I feel like I've been on the plane for longer than I was in Dubai, and I'm just off it. I arrived home about 2 hours and 20 minutes ago, so rapidly getting my feet back under the table and catching up with email. But I thought that this week we should really kick off with sort of a big picture macro ratio, and that is the Dow Gold. That I think there are two very important things that we can see from this ratio. One is that there is quite clearly a progression of higher highs, that there was a high in 1929, a high in 1965, a high in 1999. That between those three peaks, the first was 36 years, the second was 34 years, so let's say there's an average of 35 years. If this consistency is going to persist, then we would anticipate the next peak will be somewhere around 2035, 2034. If it is a higher high, which we have had two of so far, then the high would be somewhere above 45. That would be 45. The Dow Jones would trade above 45 times the price of gold. And that would represent really quite a significant bull market. But perhaps the bigger picture question is that what we see here is that there are cycles in terms of the outperformance of one asset class versus another, and that there was an important peak in 1999 following the Nasdaq bubble, correctly to call it the TMT bubble, and that was telecoms, media, and technology. And now we've seen an important low in 2011, and that there has been a significant bounce in the ratio since then, which likely represents the beginning of a new secular bull market on Wall Street, and the peak in the secular bull market in commodities. But what do secular bull markets and bear markets look like? That is, if we're going to characterize that we're in a new secular bull market for stocks, what does a secular bull market and what does a secular bear market look like? And the answer is quite clear when we look at those long-term charts. Secular bear markets look like ranges, and especially when we look at that on the logarithmic scale charts, then we are presented with these very, very long-term ranges, and these ranges can go on for upwards of 15 years, and then they are resolved by impressive breakouts. And when you get a breakout, it can go one of two ways. It will just keep going for quite a long time, and then you get a big consolidation, or you get a breakout which pulls back and finds support in the region of the upper side of the underlying range before then initiating an additional advance. We saw a consolidation in the region of the upper side of the range in 1983. We didn't really see a consolidation in the upper side of the range in 1950. We have seen a consolidation in the region of the upper side of the underlying range on this occasion. The Dow Jones ranged for upwards of 2 years, and now we are seeing a substantial breakout. And that range that we had between early 2015, or really late 2014, and at the end of 2016 was characterized by some really quite acute bouts of volatility. And that represented a pretty scary time. It represented a significant loss of uptrend consistency, particularly considering that we had a pretty volatile price action and trending between about 2010 and late 2012. And then that gave way to a very consistent advance, where we could, I think, characterize it as acceptance, that everyone accepted that we were going to have QE for a significant period of time, that the Fed was going to keep its monetary accommodation in the system for as long as it was required. And that represented a green light for traders that we were going to have this continued asset price inflation. The range that we've had over the last couple of years was reflected by the fact that the Fed was taking away some of that monetary accommodation. Now the breakout that we have had is on the expectation that monetary accommodation is going to be replaced by fiscal accommodation, and fiscal accommodation will be accompanied by deregulation, and that represents a green light for asset prices once more. And this is a very impressive breakout so far. And because it is so impressive, and it has caught people by surprise, and that is what we tend to expect, because a ranging environment contributes to a loss of expectations for future potential, that expectations for future potential deteriorate within a ranging environment, because there is no substantive evidence to support a very ambitious forecast for additional upside. And then when you have two very large pullbacks in reasonably quick succession, that then they scare people, then they are less likely to be heavily invested because they don't believe that there is going to be a substantial breakout. They're much more concerned that there will be a substantial breakdown. So then when you do get the breakout, it is surprising. And what we are definitely seeing is that a vacuum of supply had formed above the range, and now we are seeing prices rally, and they will continue to rally until they encounter supply. The index is being led higher by the banking sector. And I'm putting up the S&P 500 Banks Index, because it has experienced really quite a significant breakout, a very orderly short-term consolidation, and then it broke out again this week. Perhaps a more relevant index, though, would be the regional banks, because they represent the domestic story for the US. And this is an important chart when you look at it on the long term, because the regional banks index is at a new all-time high. And I'm going to update that chart because it is worth updating all the way up to today. This has been a revolution in terms of the appreciation for what the upside potential for banks is. And it is particularly important because for the longest time we have considered the banking sector to be a lead indicator. And it was not a lead indicator for the US for the last decade, because it represented the epicenter of risk during the crash in 2007-2008. But it is now moving back to a position of outperformance. It is now it is a sector that should benefit in a bull market, because banks are liquidity providers. And in a bull market, you need plenty of liquidity, so therefore liquidity providers should benefit. And this has been a profound change to the market, that there is a clear expectation now that regardless of some of the social implications of the new administration, that it is unreservedly pro-business, that there is the expectation that there will be a fiscal stimulus, there will be deregulation of the banking sector, there will be, and because you have fiscal stimulus, you will have higher interest rates, and that will improve the margins of the banking sector. And then you also get the potential that there will be lower corporate taxes. And the US has got some of the highest corporate taxes of any country in the world. So these are very powerful incentives to have a bullish view on the stock market. Now, regardless of those really quite bullish considerations, and that this is still a very impressive breakout, we continue to see that the VIX is quite low. It hit a new almost decade low at the beginning of February, and it is now pulling back once more. That is not least because we are seeing such a broad-based advance. But we can also see that a short-term overbought condition is being developed on some of these stock markets, and that it will eventually roll over into some form of consolidation. At quite what shape that consolidation takes is another question, because when we have had such an impressive breakout, and it is a very clear, well-defined range that lasted for almost 2 years, then, and so far, the ranges that we have had have been really quite inert. That is supportive of the view that this is clearly a demand-dominated environment. And if we are in a secular bull market, then the surprises are going to be on the upside. And that, I think, is perhaps the most important thing that we need to remember, because it is the one characteristic that people have not been expecting and have been conditioned not to expect for much of the last decade. And in fact, since we're now in 2017, it's 17 years since we had a secular bull market on Wall Street. And within a secular bear market and a very volatile ranging environment, then what you are conditioned to expect is that one should take their profits quickly, that the highs will not be sustained, and that the risks are on the downside, that the surprises will be on the downside, and that pullbacks will be very violent and very swift. That is not to say that pullbacks cannot be violent and swift in a secular bull market, but that the likelihood is that higher progressions of higher reaction lows will be held, that we will have short, sharp pullbacks, and they will represent buying opportunities. That is, I think, the most important lesson, that if we are in a secular bull market environment, that attempting to trade the pullbacks and trying to get back in at an opportune moment is going to be much more difficult, and that will eventually give way to a buy and hold type of investor. And that isn't something either that we have had much of that. There hasn't been anybody preaching that you should buy and hold stocks for a fair while now. I thought that this was a pretty opportune time to also look at currencies. The dollar index is continuing to trade around 100, but the dollar index is primarily euro. So rather than looking at that, perhaps we should just look at the euro. What one could say is that the euro has been surprisingly steady, considering what the risks are for the euro. The euro has got some major political risk, and it does represent a significant risk that there is going to have to be some major concessions made to a revisionist government if one is elected in France or the Netherlands or potentially even in Germany. There is no guarantee that Angela Merkel is going to win the German election. There is no guarantee either that Marine Le Pen is going to lose the French election. And that is before we consider that the Italian government could fall, or that the Dutch government could move to the right and move to an anti-euro bias as well. And part of the reason that you're getting this rise in populism in Europe is because we have had this fiscal straitjacket which has been imposed on large numbers of people in debtor nations, and that it has represented a period of belt tightening that seemed to have no end in sight. And that is something that that countries might have been able to anticipate, or maybe may have been able to tolerate, if they had been able to have control of their own currencies. But they don't have control of their own currencies. They're being asked to endure fiscal austerity without the support of a weakening currency that would at least support their competitiveness. This internal devaluation within the Eurozone is incredibly painful. And there is little wonder then that it is stoking anti-establishment fervor. There is an important point relating to France, and it is this, that the French were never given the opportunity to vote. They didn't get to vote on the Nice Treaty, they didn't get to vote on the Maastricht Treaty, and the reason they were not allowed to vote is because the establishment were convinced that the French people would not pass a referendum. And the success or otherwise of Marine Le Pen will be, I suspect, very much tied to her ability to cast this presidential election as a referendum on the EU. There is no EU without France. That represents a very important negotiation point for a future president. It also means that the bureaucrats within the EU will do anything to ensure that they still have jobs. And what can be done to appease the people that want to leave the EU, it would be very clear. It would be to abandon the fiscal austerity. And that would represent quite a bearish turn for the euro. So the euro has now pulled back from 108. That represents the region of the trend mean. The progression of lower rally highs remains intact, and it would really need to sustain a move above 108 to even begin to question the medium-term downward bias. And because that represents such a large component in the dollar index, then the dollar index is likely to hold that 100 level. The Japanese yen is also worth looking at, because Japan has been one of the countries that has been most active in devaluing its currency, and we have had a fairly substantial strengthening since the beginning of the year, which has represented a reversion back towards the mean. This is now the point at which we could anticipate that the yen would weaken once more. And what happens with Japan, I think, is important, and what happens with the yen is important because the TOPIX index has been going sideways for a very, very long time. You had the peak in 1989, and it has ranged in a very volatile manner between 1750. Well, it has had peaks at 1750, and there has been a progression of lower lows all the way through that range. But it is now coming back up towards that 1750 area. And if we do get a weaker yen and we get inflation picking up, and not just inflation in the US, but that we get inflation starting to advance, then inflation is something that Japan has not been successful in achieving. And part of the reason for that is both domestic and international. The deflationary impact of technology has obviously impacted their ability to achieve inflation. But we have been in a disinflationary environment since the early 1980s. So Japan was trying to achieve inflation in a global disinflationary environment, and that has to have been part of the reason why they didn't succeed in achieving inflation. Therefore, if we move into a global period of inflation, and that could possibly be tied to a move from global monetary expansion to global fiscal expansion, then there is the potential that Japan really will achieve the inflation that they have been trying to get for so long, and that this index will break upwards. That is a possibility that cannot simply be discounted. And if we do see the TOPIX breaking out to new recovery highs, then that will represent a clear change. It will represent something that is very different from the environment that we have had for the last 20 odd years. The second section index is really something that we do keep a close eye on. It has been a reliable lead indicator for Japan for the longest time, and it is now trading at new highs. It has been outperforming for a considerable period. It is at a new all-time high. And when the lead indicator for the wider market is doing that, then that would suggest that something is going on in Japan and that it is worth keeping an eye on, that this is something big might indeed be occurring. And I want to continue to focus on some of the currencies. The Indian rupee. Let me get this right. If I do INRUSD. Let me see if that's the right way around. Yes, it is. INR USD has been going down for a very long time. And if we look at that on a log scale, then we get a somewhat different picture. It looks to me to be basing, that the rupee is now testing its progression of lower rally highs. The rupee has lost downward momentum. And if we look at more back history, we can see that the rupee has been trending lower for a very long time. There are a number of data points that have appeared on India that are really worthy of mention. The first is the demonetization. And that was a clear attempt to try and squeeze some of the cash out of the system and onto any kind of way of recording invoices, recording transactions, so that it could be taxed. India went from 2G to 4G in the last 2 months, and that is a profound change. Not only then do you have the incentive to be banked, but that there is the potential that you would not have to go to a retail bank network, that there is the potential that online banking could become a big deal in India. India has got a vast young population, and Apple just opened their first factory there. So that is a vote of confidence. The clear objective of India, and it really does need to get it done, is to create a manufacturing sector. I've often made the point that India has what China needs, and China has what India needs. India has a rather vibrant domestic economy, and India has a pretty impressive export sector in high technology already, that there are a substantial number of healthcare companies that have operations in India, and it has been enormously successful in the offshoring of IT services. But what it doesn't have is manufacturing, and it doesn't have infrastructure. China has those in abundance, but it doesn't have the vibrant domestic economy to nearly the same extent that India does. And it obviously does not have the IT services sector that it can export, and not least because of language differences. India has to invest in manufacturing because it has got a vast young population. And if it is going to really harvest the demographic dividend that it has right now, then it has to get manufacturing up and running. And most importantly, it has to get it done quickly because of the march of technological innovation, the release of robot sewing machines and seamless sewing machines. That is a clear threat to the ability of very poor countries to innovate and to really get onto the first rung of the development ladder. That textile manufacture is so very cost sensitive that it is usually the first industry that starts, and we see manufacturing of garments occurring in Bangladesh. We see it in Pakistan. You know, if you just go to your wardrobe and read the labels, how often do you see manufacturing from India? And it is quite rare, and they really do need to get about it, because they have so many young people, they need to find work for them. And what this chart is saying is that with inflation starting to come down, with the clear benefit that India gets from lower commodity prices, despite the fact that commodity prices have bounced, they are still substantially below where they were a few years ago, and that is enormously beneficial for a country like India. That there is the real possibility that the rupee can break its downtrend, and if it can, it is going to be a green light for foreign investors, because they will then get the currency market appreciation and the capital market appreciation, and that is sort of the magic formula that they look for. And the Indian government bond is still at an attractive yield. It's at 6.85%, and it has been rallying pretty substantially. So Now we are at a point where it is testing the region of the 200-day moving average, and that yield has been compressing for a fair amount of time already. Now the question is whether it is going to move higher from here. This is going to be a big question for India. If the rupee does indeed strengthen from here, then demand for Indian bonds should improve. So that should put some downward pressure on the government bond yield. But what it also tells us is that this is a key period of time. And the banking index in India has tended to be a pretty impressive lead indicator, and it is now testing its all-time high, and it has raced to get up here, so we might have some consolidation. It has been ranging below the 25,000 level for 2 years already, and there might be a pause in the consolidation, but it would really need to take out the 20,000 level to question potential for this to continue to move higher. If India is a beneficiary from lower for longer commodity prices, Brazil is a beneficiary of the current advance, and the real has strengthened pretty impressively over the last year and a half. It is a little bit overbought in the short term. The South African rand moved to a new recovery high this week, and there was news too that there has been some rigging of the currency markets in South African rand trading. So that may also have contributed to it, but what we have seen is that there has been a high degree of commonality in the rallies that we've seen in large number of commodity currencies, and that they are a bit overbought in the short term. Of course, all of these countries are major commodity producers, and oil is by far the most important of those. And oil prices have been very inert. And this is not normal. Oil prices are not characteristically this inert. They are characteristically extremely volatile. This has been a very well-defined range for nearly the last 3 months, and in a very tight range as well, that it has gone from about $54 to $57. And just to put that in context, oil quite clearly can rally that amount in a day. But what we also see is, and if we just look at the bid prices, that April 2017 is trading at $55 and January 2019 is trading at $55. So therefore, the futures curve is very flat. That you have to go all the way out to 2021 before you get prices back up to $56.50. That would suggest that this is an environment where a large amount of hedging future production has already occurred. Any arbitrage that was in the market has already been traded out of it. And that is suggestive of a simple fact, that there is a break-even point for a lot of marginal supply. And by marginal supply, we can say that U.S. onshore unconventional oil and gas is the new swing producer globally, because because of their horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, that the pace with which they are willing to drill new holes, it gives them a great degree of control over how much they produce and when they produce. That means that if we've seen this very flat curve where there is only a couple of dollars difference over 3 and 4 years of trading, that they have already sold out their production for a number of years forward, which gives us a clear indication that that is economic for them to do so. It also means that they can invest, because they are only, if they borrow money now to invest in future production, then they are only risking that small amount of money that they're borrowing. They have already hedged out, so they are basically securing their balance sheets. And that is part of the reason that it is quite difficult for prices to rally from here. What one would be betting on in order for prices to rally from here would be an uptick in economic growth that would outstrip the short-term capability of unconventional oil and gas to increase supply. One of the reasons that prices were able to get up to this level is because OPEC and Saudi Arabia in particular had decided that they would finally pull back on some of their supply, which was at record levels. They have, and that was an admittance of failure, that they failed to drive unconventional supply out of the market. That's really important because if they want to sustain prices above $60, then they are probably going to have to cut supply even further, at least until economic growth picks up. And we probably should look at government bonds, because government bond yields are at a pivotal juncture. And that's something, and I am not can't talk and chew gum. Let me just type this in correctly this time. So, US government bond yields are at 2.4% right now. And that is something that is a really pivotal period. Because everyone who has been active in the market for the last 30 years of this incredible bull market will have been conditioned to continue to buy the dip. Buying the dip is the strategy that works best. And my Bloomberg just, I had to kind of tell it to don't log me out. It kind of did it anyway. But what the winning strategy in any bull market is to buy the dip. The longer that the market persists, the greater the incentive is to continue to buy the dip because it continues to work. If you buy the dip on every pullback in a bull market, you are almost guaranteed to make money. And this is one of the longest bull markets in history. It is almost 36 years and counting at present. And there is now the argument whether you should buy the dip today at 2.5%-ish. And there is a countervailing argument that this it has been a substantial run-up in yields already and that interest rates are rising and that that is quite different to the run-up that we saw in 2013. I personally think that that is indeed the case, that this is different, that we have had a profound change. If we look at history, we also know that it takes a while for government bond yields to turn, that they do not get these V bottoms. And it is worth considering that there was an important low in 2012 and we are now in 2017. So the bottoming process in government bond yields has already been going on for almost a full 5 years. Sometimes, and if we look at the very, very long-term history, I'm going to try and get my hands on the really long-term the bond yield chart that one of the other presenters had at this conference I was at in Dubai this week. But he had it for he had government bond yields for the last 200 years, and he was able to demonstrate that it can take anything from 5 to 10 years for yields to bottom. So we are 5 years into the bottoming process, and a break above 3% would confirm that this base formation has been completed. We are currently at a point where there is an argument going on, and I don't think that it is an exaggeration to say that it is a war going on between supply and demand, between those that say that you should continue to buy the dip, that nothing has really changed, that we are still in a deflationary environment overall, and those that believe that something really has changed, and that we are moving into an inflationary environment, that interest rates are rising for the first time in almost a decade, and that that really is a big change, and that there is, if economic growth is improving, and that we do get fiscal spending, that the potential for inflation to pick up and the potential for investors to require an additional yield because of the fiscal expansion, then and the questions about how that stimulus or deficit spending is eventually going to be funded, then there is a logical reason for why investors would demand a higher yield. But the fact that we can still have that argument is characteristic of the fact that we are still within this range, and that this is still a reversionary environment where we had a big move and now we're getting a mean reversion. A sustained move above 3 would complete the base. The higher yields go, the greater the headwind they are going to be for stocks. So far, the run-up in yields is being characterized by enthusiasm that economic growth is picking up, and that has been very good for stocks. If Wall Street is advancing, and something that we talked a lot about in the last decade was the Wall Street leash effect, that we look at that Japanese chart and we can see that the market is improving. The Taiwanese index is also breaking upwards, or I guess it has not yet broken upwards, but it is trading back up towards the upper side of a very long-term range. The SET index in Thailand is testing the upper side of its range. We've looked at Japan already, but the Korean market is testing the upper side of a 5-year range. So when we look at these long-term charts, we can see that there have been very lengthy periods of consolidation for some of Asia's big developed markets. And generally speaking, there is a common thread running through all of them, and that it is that they are, generally speaking, US allies. Perhaps the most unloved of all markets right now is China, and not without good reason. There is still substantial uncertainty about the ability of the current administration to shepherd the financial markets. They have really made a mess of regulation, and they have made a mess of the rollout of government bond futures and the options market, and that has contributed to bubbly characteristics in all. The H share index now, though, is trading above the 10,000 level. It is heavily weighted by the banks. And Chinese banks are not expensive. The FTSE China A600 Banks Index has continued to hold this progression of higher reaction lows. It looks almost exactly like the A share index, whereas the HSCEI looks a little bit more consistent and is breaking on the upside. If we go back and look at the currencies, then the renminbi is trending lower, and it is trending lower in a reasonably consistent manner. And it is currently in a reversionary rally back to the mean, but that it would really need to sustain a move below the mean to question that the renminbi isn't going to remain on a consistent pattern of devaluation. The Chinese need a weaker currency. The big question is going to be about Europe, and in what currency are the stock markets going to be denominated in? Despite the fact that we have that question, the Wall Street leash effect is continuing to act as a tailwind for the European stock market generally. The DAX index has continued to outperform, and it is trading pretty close to its high from the post euro devaluation peak in 2015. The FTSE 100 in the UK is trading at new all-time highs, are pretty darn close to new all-time highs. And when we look at that really long-term chart, we are treated to a great picture of a very long-term range with a trough-to-peak swing, almost 100%, a large consolidation in the region of the upper side of the range for a lengthy period of time, and now we're moving to new all-time highs. This is an important breakout. And the fact that the UK The UK's FTSE 100 is loaded with globally oriented companies, companies that benefit most when the global economy is doing well, and that it is now breaking upwards. That is certainly a point to support the view that we are moving into a period of better economic growth, that growth could surprise on the upside, and that that will act as a tailwind for stock markets over the medium term. Well, I started out talking about the Dow gold ratio, so we really should look at the gold price. And the gold price is closing out the week at 1234.95. It is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. The big question is, at this stage, is it going to hold this advance? Or is it going to have a somewhat larger pullback? Or is it going to remain within this inert range and then be able to push successfully above $1,250? It is a big question. And the much broader question about gold is not so much whether we're going to get another 10 years of consecutive advances. I don't think that that is going to be the case. The broader question is that we are towards the lower side of what could be a lengthy range, and that prices are now reasonably priced. There is the potential that with the kind of uncertainty that we have with other currencies, that gold could be seen as a real safe haven. But gold tends to do best when interest rates are not keeping up with inflationary expectations. And over the last few months, interest rates have been rising faster than inflation, and that has been a headwind for gold. If that condition turns around, then we can anticipate that gold will move higher, and that it has the potential to go from the lower side of its range back up to the upper side of its range. And we can anticipate that gold now has potential for short, sharp, medium-term moves, but that the potential for a super cycle has been offset now, and it will probably be a number of years before we could really justify the potential for a secular bull market in gold prices. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.